This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing. No!
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
This particular piranha vanished 2 million years ago.
Welcome everybody to Cinematica Animalia, the podcast where we break down the biology of movie monsters. Today we are doing a one-off episode on the concept of real monsters or real animals in movies as kind of horror icons. Looking at three, I'm not going to say classics, I'll say pleasantly enjoyable B-films. The three films we're going to look at are Piranha 3D, Lake Placid, and Deep Blue Sea. Not necessarily in that order, we'll see how we go. And as always, there's time goes below, so you can skip ahead to the part of the episode you're looking for. Anyway, but before we get into it, my name's Sam Perrin. I am a freshwater / invasive ecologist at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses, alongside co-host number one, Adam Harsick, a disease / parasite ecologist at the University of Arkansas. We are your movie ecologists. We're joined every week by co-host number two, Dave, who is a vet and our movie physiologist. And we are also joined today by Libby Young. Libby, do you want to introduce yourself and what you do?
Yes, I am a female, as you can hear. No, I am also from Arkansas. Not Arkansas.
Two different states, different pronunciation.
Exactly. No, I have an undergrad bachelor's degree in creative writing, so I am here to assist with storylines and plot continuity and having three men explain science to me. So
yeah, good times. That's what every woman wants, right?
Oh, God. It got said out loud and now my soul hurts.
No, but we brought Libby on because we want somebody who actually knows a bit about filmmaking to be like, hey, if you made this more scientifically realistic, would it work? Which I don't know. And today, especially with one of these films, I already think the story doesn't work, even though the creature's real. Anyway, look, we'll get into it. So this is, I mean, it's a thing that's used a lot. We generally think of horror movie monsters as being these weird, like, and the ones we've touched on. So we looked at the Forest God from The Ritual. What else have we looked at? The big gorilla wolf motherfuckers.
Plenty of things that aren't quite real.
Yeah. Aliens, the xenomorphs, gremlins. Yeah. But today we are looking at three creatures, which are very much just real creatures with slightly exaggerated features. Yeah. And it does happen. I mean, there's a Sharknado.
We have those in Arkansas all the time, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're actually in Sharknado Alley. In this part of the country.
Oh, okay, nice. Oh, valley or alley? How extensive is it?
I would love to see your insurance policies.
Yeah.
Pretty bad.
What else is, like, sharks are obviously a really common one. Even in the last couple of years, you've had The Shallows, Beyond the Shallows with Blake.
47 meters down.
Yeah, 47 meters down. That's the one where they're stuck, like, at the bottom of the sea.
In a cage.
There was a really good found footage one a couple of years ago, I think. Just those people who get stuck in the middle of the ocean.
Let's not forget Jaws.
Yep.
Yeah, well, that's not recent, is it, Libby?
You're not recent.
But what's another organism that that pops up a lot in these films? Crocodiles, not so much.
I was going to say one of the very first science fiction stories that has been redone and done in a million ways, the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is, I mean, classic giant kraken, right? The giant squid. Yep.
Yeah, there's also the beast.
Mm-hmm.
That was a really fun one that I liked a lot.
There was a giant squid in the Meg, I'm pretty sure.
Well, in Pirates of the Caribbean, too, as well.
Oh, yeah.
Kraken.
The actual Kraken.
True, yeah. And then what else has popped up? Aquatic monsters are a big one, but I think that really ties into how, you know, freaky this, you know, just endless abyss is. I mean, you swim right out into the sea, you look down, you have no idea what's coming up.
It could be Sam.
Yeah, my partner will not easily do bodies of water that she can't see the bottom of. And, like, Piranha that we watched last night has not helped any of those fears going forward.
Oh, that's a terrible film, yeah. Piranha's actually, like, there's a 70s version, right, you were saying?
Yeah, which, yeah, it looks awful. It's got Mila Kunis in it, though, as a kid. It's like a young acting role for her from, like, or younger from 1995.
Wait, what, Mila Kunis? Yeah, that's... but what else has often popped up in film? I feel like on land, there's spiders have turned up a few times, eight-legged freaks.
Does that say eight-legged freaks?
Arachnophobia.
Yeah. I remember there was a spate of films around the time of Anaconda that popped up.
Yeah.
It was Razorback, some killer pigs. There was an Australian one as well.
There's the Korean film called Chaw. It's about a giant pig.
Snakes on a plane.
Yeah, snakes were big for a while, yeah. We still haven't had that emu horror film that we're all waiting on.
We're all waiting on?
What emu horror film? You're not waiting on an emu horror film?
No.
It's called Life in Australia.
I was about to say.
Don't really have to exaggerate anything there.
And then Beaver for Dam. We were discussing this yesterday.
Yeah. But, I mean, almost all of these are, you know, you take a creature and you give it very exaggerated features, which don't quite work out in the real world. Libby, how do you think you could take, like, just a normal creature that's out there in the world and write a plot line whereby it works as a horror movie, as a, you know, a horror movie icon?
You know, I was thinking about that, and the one that comes to mind is the Liam Neeson movie, The Grey, where they take a wolf.
Oh!
And they don't, you know, bastardize it at all. It's just a wolf. And it behaves very much like a wolf, and yet you're terrified for him the entire time. But then also somehow, like, kind of rooting for the wolves.
Oh. I was definitely rooting for the wolf the entire
time. Yeah. Because I haven't seen that movie, but a lot of it is talking about, like, the conflict between people, right? Mm-hmm. Which is not to take away from the wolves. I mean, that's a core part of any horror film.
No, but it's also dealing with the conflict between man and nature.
Yes, big time. Yeah, not just, like, the classic struggle of, like, man versus nature, but, like, man encroaching upon a habitat that already existed with creatures that have evolved and adapted to this certain kind of lifestyle that now people are moving in on. And you have a person like Liam Neeson's character, his entire job is to defend like an oil company or whatever the settlement is from these wolves because they have lived here and they're used to eating here. So it's a problem.
Yeah. I feel the only contrivance there is that the wolves generally stay the hell away from humans. If they can, right?
And I mean, I guess that's the breaking point of any of these horrors is trying to recognize that human beings are the scariest thing at the end of the day, right? You've got us versus any animal, and the realistic, like, we'll get a little bit more into it, but watching Piranha, Vin Rames' character and David Hasselhoff, because we also watched the second one last night. We were drinking and decided to just watch both.
Perfect.
Nice.
They make the point of, like, I don't understand why the humans are so scared, because they're just going to leave the water and they're going to poison and kill everything that's in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely. Like, yeah, like, that's 100%. Like, there wouldn't be any, like, joke or comment. Like, it threatens human life in any way and we're, like, exterminate it.
Yeah.
We'll get into that later, but yeah, rotenone treatment is something we've been doing since, like, the 50s and 40s to wipe out fish in freshwater lakes. Yeah. It's expensive, but... I mean, so is having a pack of killer piranha in your lake.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was going to say another great movie that is suspenseful, but also where they take a animal and make it the central terror is the Ghost in the Darkness.
Ooh. Sorry, yeah, that is the one I was about to say, yeah. Because that's based on real life events, yeah.
Absolutely. Those lions are terrifying.
Yeah. So the story was in India, right? A British colonial kind of putting together a railway track back in the... 1800s?
Yeah, something like that.
I think, yeah. And these two, the Savo man-eaters, I think they're called, were just picking, like, railway workers off. Mm-hmm. So poor railway workers, people who weren't in the best condition, are locals conscripted by, you know, I'm assuming British colonials. And I think they took something like over 100 local workers over the course of their, before they were hunted down and killed.
Yep.
And I haven't seen that. Libby, you've seen that film?
Yes. I watched it as a kid and I was terrified.
Yeah.
Lions don't do this. Lions never had a lair like this. They're doing it for the pleasure.
They are not lions. They are the ghost and the darkness.
Anyway, so should we dive into to today's movies?
Yes, please.
Awesome. So before we start looking at today's films, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Sam Perrin, NTNU. Adam is at Hasik Adam, Hasik. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit cinematicaanimalia.com or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. If you want to hear about more of the hardcore science that Adam and I write about, you can check us out at ecologyforthemasses.com. Okay, so Lake Placid is what we're going to start with. For those who don't know, this film is essentially there's a massive crocodile who gets to 30 feet, which I think it's because 30 feet is like 10 meters.
It's about
right?
10 meters.
Yeah, about 10 meters. Okay. Which is found in a lake in upstate Maine.
Basically, Canada.
Yeah. Right on the border with Canada. North, the top right corner.
Mm-hmm.
It might as well be Canada when you look at the scenery and that sort of stuff. And this enormous crocodile gets into a lake. Woman Jane Fonda gets sent up there by the American Natural History Museum to check it out. Meets Brendan Gleeson, giving one of the worst American accents I've ever heard in a film in my life.
Yeah, undetectable.
I couldn't even tell if he was trying half the time. It was incredible. And Bill Pullman, when he was at the height of his post-Independence Day powers.
Oh, Bill Pullman.
Yes.
Yeah. And look, I really like this. I think it's got one of the best romantic storylines in 90s films between Brendan Gleeson and Oliver Platt. I think it's just a beautiful romance that blossoms throughout the film. Oh, yeah, of course, Oliver Platt's in this. If you don't know who Oliver Platt is...
Three Musketeers.
Yep.
Yeah, Three Musketeers. Yeah. I was searching through. I can't find a more iconic role off the top of my head.
You might not know his face or his roles, but like you hear that name, you're like, oh, yeah, that's an actor.
You also forgot about the bromance between Oliver Platt and the crocodile.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. True. Yeah.
That he quickly forgets about as soon as he sees that crocodile.
There's a big crocodile and they've got to get it out of the lake. It's a pretty bare bones plot.
Also Betty White, and she's amazing.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
When is she not?
If I had a dick, this is where I would tell you to suck it. Thank you, Betty White.
Yeah. It's a wonderful line. There's a lot of good lines in this. Oliver Platt's, what is it? Brendan Gleeson says, you can't get a crocodile up here. And he's just like, well, that'll be your little secret then.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you see, they hide this information in books.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
That is a wonderful line.
I haven't broken any laws.
Oh, but you have, ma'am. You lied to us. That could be obstruction of justice. A man has been killed in part because of your silence. I could make out a charge of reckless endangerment. And I'm sure PETA would be annoyed at how you treat your cows.
The reason I lied, if I told you the truth, you'd hunt it down and kill it, which seems to be exactly what you're trying to do.
Yeah, I think we all kind of like this film.
I love that film.
Oh, it's great.
It's fantastic.
That was one of those movies that I used to rent. That one, Andy Blue Sea. Go to Blockbuster, late 90s, early 2000s, and rent that movie repeatedly and just watch it with friends.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I watched it when I was younger as well. I was worried that I'd come back and watch it older and find out it hadn't aged well, like a certain other film we're talking about today. But yeah, I thought it was fantastic. But let's start with what is, you know, realistic here about the crocodile. Saltwater crocodiles exist.
It's not too much bigger than a real one. I mean, it's obviously a lot bigger.
It's about double.
You very rarely get them above 5 meters. They're really hard to find. Like, I was looking through a lot of the literature before this.
He would be the biggest that we've ever seen. Like, his size is still quite a bit above what we would expect to see.
Yeah.
They're usually between 2 and 4 meters. You do get them above 5 meters, but very rarely. There's been a lot of studies on comparing, you know, length, body length to head length and body length to swimming speed and, you know, kind of anaerobic metabolism, that sort of stuff. They very rarely find enough crocs above 4 meters to make anything above that length statistically significant. So this guy, I don't know if he's the male and the smaller one is the female or vice versa.
I don't know if they ever officially say. What were you saying?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. I don't know which one was supposed to be which.
So the fan fiction that I can find, they all refer to him as like male croc or big croc.
But I feel like that's very kind of 90s. If you have a big horror thing that doesn't have a sex, everybody assumes it's male.
I think that's just also still a current thing. If you don't know what it is, you're going to call it a guy.
Yeah, I mean, the croc is referred to as he throughout the entire film. But yes, sexing crocodiles is also rather difficult. So.
I was going to ask how you sex a crocodile.
You got to lift up their skirts, just like Jeff Goldblum says in Jurassic Park.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That documentary.
So saltwater crocodiles do migrate thousands of kilometers. I mean, their distribution range is enormous. It's most of Southeast Asia and the northern coast of Australia. So when I was back in Australia a year and a half ago, when we got up past Cairns into like Cape Tribulation, that area, you can't go swimming in the beaches because there's crocodiles there all the time.
Sounds like Florida.
Yeah.
I found while digging multiple accounts from, because everybody names their quiet lake Lake Placid all over the world. So there are multiple Lake Placids. There are 2 Lake Placids in Australia that keep getting saltwater crocodiles.
Really?
The government keeps coming and being like, hey guys, don't go swimming because we saw it and it might have taken a dog. And I found the most recent were one from 2016 and one from 2017. And the residents are so nonchalant about it, like a typical Australian being like, the croc's back in the water again.
Yeah. It's weird. When we were up in Cape Tribulation, we had to ask, you know, where can you go to find rivers where there's no crocodile? And they said, look, there shouldn't be any crocodiles here. And I'm fine with that as an excuse. But Cammy was just like, hang on, shouldn't?
Yeah. What do you mean, shouldn't be?
Yeah. But we went swimming in like clear water. So you could see them if they were there.
You sure it's not a log?
Cammy's swimming with a harpoon the entire time.
Yeah. It's, I mean, that's one thing that pops up in this movie. They're constantly, like, they've got their heads over the water when they don't need to. Because, I mean, crocodiles can swim along without disturbing the water surface at all. It's one of the things that's terrifying about them. It could be, like, 2 meters away from you and swimming towards you, and you wouldn't see no disturbance. So, the fact that this one has constantly just got its eyes above the lake looking at its prey.
Its entire head.
Yeah. Actually, that is a good point. That would take effort to lift its entire head, unless it's, like, just really shallow at that point.
Or if it's salt water and pushing it up, but it's not, because it's a freshwater lake in Maine.
Which is totally fine for saltwater crocodiles.
Yeah, they can spend time in freshwater, and they often do. It wouldn't get this big in freshwater, though, I don't think, and especially not in a lake that's small.
Not in that lake.
Because, Dave, we were talking about this before. I mean, we've talked about distribution ranges. The bigger a creature it gets, the bigger, the more space it needs, because it's got to get resources. You're more likely to get that from a larger area. That reduces if you're getting your diet supplemented from somewhere. It's, you know, like Adam and I were talking about on the cats episode. That's why you get cats together in smaller spaces, because humans supplement their diet. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, Dave, what were you saying about the price of cows?
Yeah.
I mean, I was just, as an estimate, I went looking through the current market prices that are associated with cows in the United States. Now, it's heavily implied that she's got cows on the farm. And so it's like, all right, you know, maybe that's what she's doing.
Yeah, all six of them.
All right. Cows are in no way, shape, cheap. I mean, the size of the cow that she would potentially be feeding would be somewhere around, like, basically, so, I mean, when it's brought to market, it can depend anywhere from $2,000 to $5,000. If you're talking about, like, yearlings, like a cow that's only developed over a 12-month period, that's still $800 to $1,500 in the United States. But, like, she's feeding a full-grown cow in that film. Like, it's she walks up, like, it's got to be at least 18 months old.
Yeah.
I have a plot theory on this, that really her herd, her resource, is the actual crocodile. So she's using the cows to feed, and then she sells those crocs on the black market, and that's how she makes her money.
Mm.
Oh,
she's
nice.
Bringing the cows in from somewhere else, because there's no pasture there.
Yeah.
There's not enough to support the number of cows even that she has in the film.
Yeah.
Dave, if somebody was selling cows to her, legally, the cows are being sold legally, obviously the crocs aren't, but if the cows are being sold legally to her, would somebody have an obligation to report that if they rock up to sell her a bunch of cows and they see that, I've sold this woman like 500 cows over the last 2 years and she's only got four on the farm. What's going on here?
I mean,
like,
they're going to start to become curious is going to be the bigger issue. Like, I don't know if any farmer, like, one, it's pretty rare to just buy, like, single cows, right? Most of the time, like, the only way you make money, it's like anything else, you have to have herds. And unfortunately, in the United States, beef producers get absolutely screwed. They can barely make money legally as it is. That's why we have to have farm subsidies to try and, like, back them up. So it would be odd. Whoever was delivering this, one, it would be a really strange order for them to be bringing this cow out to a small farm on the side of a lake on a regular basis.
Yep.
Two, it would definitely start raising questions of, like, why the fuck am I delivering one cow every month?
Yeah.
I understand you've got, like, four cows there, but you always have four cows, and I'm always delivering a cow, and it goes missing. Like, maybe they'd be thinking, like, Betty White might be able to say, like, she's just, you know, some little hippy dippy woman and she's like killing a cow to like put it in her freezer. But like a human doesn't go through a cow a month.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you guys heard, but Cammy was in the background giving a suggestion that this woman's old. Perhaps the people selling her the cows just like, oh, she's an old batty woman. She must just be letting them wander off and buying more. And
maybe, or maybe they just think she is running some sort of secret market where she's selling them and they just don't care.
Yeah.
But transport would be an issue and it would just be odd. Like, I don't know if it would be worth it for the farmer to be driving a cow out once a month and delivering it to her. You don't tend to do like single deliveries.
But also an issue is just how often this thing eats.
Yeah. 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 It'd need like a cow every two, 3 weeks at least. Like I would think.
Cow, moose, people, grizzly bear.
I guess it'd take deer. It'd take moose, obviously. But in the lake itself, like aquatic life, there's nothing in there that's going to be worth it taking.
I don't know.
Beavers, maybe, but for the smaller one.
But I don't think it would be justifiable. Like maybe deer that would walk over and drink at the side of the water.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, deer and moose, stuff that comes to drink there. In any case, it wouldn't. This is a saltwater crocodile from the tropics. It's not going to be able to survive in Maine for a winter. Alligators do. There are some species of alligator which can survive. They do a thing. It's close to hibernation, but it's called brumation. What they do is when the lakes freeze over, they will stick their snouts up through the tops of the ice. So this has happened a bunch of times before, and it turns places into like weird tourist and mini tourist attractions. You will get a lake where there are alligators, and you'll like it'll freeze over, and you'll just be able to go there and see all these alligator snouts poking out through the ice, which I think is just an amazing phenomenon. I don't know if this is like normal in some parts of America, but that to me is fascinating. But it's a mechanism that allows them to survive for short periods of extreme cold. If this thing is close to the coast, which it might be, because I mean it's been able to migrate up there from the coast, then I don't know. It probably is going to be a little milder. But Dave, is it going to be able to survive a winter in Maine?
I don't know. Because I mean, the biggest issues become with it, one, its size.
Yeah.
So like the biggest issues that bears have, because the only way that hibernation works, you can totally do it, but you have to reset where your resting temperature works, right? It's the reason we get cold is you're outside, you're constantly trying to fight to get your temperature up to wherever your metabolic needs have been set, wherever your enzymes and material need to operate best, which is why you get cold, because your body's like, screw you, dude, I have to try to warm us back up to, you know, that 37.6 that we like to operate at, or I think humans are 38.3, whatever. But for a large, most reptiles, they're usually small enough that, and their body temperatures are more plastic. They're able to arrange things at different levels to set them at different periods that they're fine with. But large animals like bears, the whole problem that they run into is that they have to drop their resting metabolic rate down quite a bit, and which is why they can't truly hibernate. They're just too big. They have too much body mass that if they did, in fact, cool themselves down, they'd have a lot of trouble warming back up. Now, reptiles do have ways of avoiding this, but I don't know what its metabolic demands were. One, I don't know how thick the ice would form during the winter, because that becomes the other problem, right? A nice little quick sheet of ice that you can get your nose through, totally fine. But if the entire ice freezes over with like 2 or 3 feet, like enough that humans can go out and walk on the ice, you're going to have your head frozen in an ice block.
Yeah. And again, this isn't that species of alligator. This is a tropical saltwater crocodile. Right. I mean, they don't come lower than like central Queensland.
No. And so unless it's taken on some mechanism like Canadian turtles or other species that can actually like hibernate, burrow into anoxic mud low oxygen mud at the bottom of waterways, I don't see it being able to replicate the typical pattern. I don't think it would be able to easily hibernate in the water, and it's not like it's going to evolve, because as we've discussed before, you don't get single animal evolution.
No.
So this thing would be screwed in this cold water.
I think so. I think it would start to get slower and slower and more sluggish, and then either things would freeze over and it would become trapped and then die, or it would attempt to do some modified behavior, sticking its nose throughout the ice, at which point it would die. And it's too big to go on to land and do anything. Like we've probably seen those like little frogs that will freeze, or other small reptiles that can actually become frozen and then warm up during the summertime and return to normal function. It's far too big for that.
And the other thing is that like crocodiles start slowing right down at about 18 degrees, saltwater crocodiles. So once it drops below 18 degrees, their movement's going to slow anyway. And your relative aerobic swimming performance in crocodiles starts to drop after you get past a certain length. And that certain length is normally around 4.5 to 5 meters, according to a couple of studies from Australian saltwater crocodiles, which this is supposedly. And so if you've got a 10-meter crocodile in Maine, it's not really going to be able to hunt anything. Like, it's going to be able to accept cows from Bretty White, but I mean...
So as it gets colder and colder, certain crocodile species that do survive, so salt waters that can exist in areas of Australia that get quite cold during the winter times, they're not actually able to eat anymore.
Yeah, you can't digest at a certain point, right?
They don't have their temperatures aren't running at the areas that their enzymes and their other metabolic processes need them to properly break down and digest what they're eating. And so they usually just go hungry during the winter times if they have to survive in those areas. But like temperature fluctuations that would be affecting this guy that would be running into in Maine would put this poor fellow in an area where even if he could eat something, he's very unlikely to be able to digest it all the way through.
My feet are f***ing freezing.
So we've got this massive slow croc that can't really eat. It can't really hunt. Now for our resident story expert, Libby, how does the story work now?
I would think maybe a barn would come into play and heat lamps and Betty White sustaining this thing during winter months.
Ooh. There you go. I like that.
I mean, the thing is, you could just set it further south. But, I mean, one of the whole things of the film is everybody's being like, you can't get a crocodile up in Maine.
Yeah.
With good reason, as it turns out.
But I do like Libby's idea. If Betty White was able to prepare, if there was some sort of off-site area that we didn't see, where the croc's metabolic activity was quite low, it became very sluggish and basically moved into this area where it was fairly easy to keep in captivity. It had some sort of like small pool or area that she'd cut out of concrete or made use of some existing farm structure. And this thing just kind of sat there. She kept it at a certain temperature where it was still sluggish and docile and kind of barely moved, and then kept it there during the winter time. Maybe it would lose weight and it would look pretty shitty by the time that like spring and summer started to roll around. The bigger concern would be getting it in there. And then also temperature fluctuations, as Sam was explaining, that might affect it just on a day-to-day. Like, would Maine get warm enough even during its summers? The minute we started to get into spring and fall, this thing would start suffering deleteriously.
Yeah. Libby, do you think there's, like, a happy medium here where you set it in a place just, I mean, because we kind of cover this, the fact that it can't migrate that far. They are known to migrate thousands of kilometers across seas. But this is like the whole Pacific Ocean,
right?
Or the whole Atlantic Ocean.
The Atlantic Ocean as well.
Libby, do you think there's like a happy medium where you could have it, say, escape from a zoo in Florida, go up the coast to a point where it's still kind of unrealistic to have a saltwater crocodile, but it's south enough? Do you think that ruins the contrivance of you can't get a crocodile up here, or could you still do it?
No, and I think we've seen that in other movies where you have, you know, people that flush pet crocodiles or gators down the toilet and then they get into a pond or a lake or whatever, or what have you.
New York sewers.
Yeah, so I don't think that ruins it. I think that would be a fairly logical plot.
Okay.
Yeah, but I do think it would have to be slightly warmer.
Big time.
Yeah, so what, because I don't know the US, I don't know the US very well. I'm just looking at a map here. What's Denver like? Is that DE? I'm assuming. Oh, Delaware. Sorry, Delaware. I saw DE. What is Denver? Is it like DV or something?
It's Colorado.
That's Denver's a city.
Oh, right. Denver's a city. Okay. Well, there you go. Sorry.
Yeah. What's the state of Sydney like?
But I'm trying. Okay. It's in the middle. We have 8 states. You have 50. 8 states. We have 6 states. You have 50. Okay. There's lots of them.
In 2 territories.
Sorry. Where's Delaware? How's that?
Delaware's still pretty cold.
Yeah, it's still pretty cold.
Yeah. How far south would you have to go? North Carolina?
North Carolina could work.
Okay. Virginia, yeah?
Virginia would work.
Would Brendan Gleeson's accent work better in any of these states?
Fuck no.
No? Okay. Right.
But Betty White would work pretty well in Virginia.
Betty White would work anywhere. But imagine, if you will, Brendan Gleeson doing a southern accent.
North Carolina accent.
Oh my God.
I mean, no offense, guys, but from an overseas perspective, the southern accent is a lot more like exaggerated. So surely he could just like go full into some like, you know, what I sound like when I do a southern accent, like just ridiculous over the top that doesn't sound realistic. And surely that'd work for some Americans.
That's a North Carolina accent.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. Yep. There you go.
Yeah. Imagine Daniel Craig in Knives Out, but not as refined sounding. Kind of more like that higher twang to it.
But I love that accent. Is it ridiculous though? Does it not work at all?
It works. It seems very exaggerated, though.
Okay.
Okay.
A couple of other things about this movie are the perch freaking out. Like, they make a big point of, like, these perch thrashing around. Like, perch aren't going to be worried about this thing. It's not colorful.
No. It's a really cool effect, though.
This is her first time in the field, which is ridiculous. I work at the NTNU, but I work at the Natural History Museum here. I've been in the field, like, within my first year, despite the fact that I do mainly statistical modeling. I refuse to buy that she's never been in the field before.
Yeah, but it's also, it doesn't make sense to send someone who is a paleontologist to look at what might be a live and, like, extant creature.
Well, in fairness, they don't send her to look at the creature, they just send her to look at the tooth.
Yeah.
And then she takes it upon herself to...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Because she wants to get the hell out of there, because there's an affair between Marissa Hargitay, who...
Mariska Hargitay.
What's going on? Is that Hargitay?
Mariska Hargitay.
Mariska Hargitay, okay. Yeah, she pops up out of nowhere. That was a blast from the past.
Wasn't it?
Half expected to hear the dun-dun afterwards. SVU theme. I can't do it properly. Yeah. I think that's all I had on this.
Yeah.
Oh, the whole contrivance of this, right, is that there's a crocodile in the lake and it's a danger. But it's not a danger at all. Just don't go in the lake. And there's this whole thing of, like, we have to save it. They're going to kill it. Are they going to kill it? Do you know that?
Probably.
If in America, yeah. If they find out that it's taken human life, then, yeah.
It's done.
It's done.
Really?
Oh, we just had a woman this week die from a gator. It was pretty bad, the gator was just down at the water surface. Her friend said, "Don't go down there. You know, I just saw it take a deer from that same spot last week." And so she wanted to go take a picture, and so she got snatched, and they recovered her body, but they put the gator down.
Yeah, we've had mixed responses to a lot of shark attacks in Australia before. Like, half the time, you'll get people who are calling for, like, you know, stronger measures from great whites. Great whites are never really a problem, by the way. They just kind of move on all the time. But tiger sharks can hang around a lot.
Yep.
But generally, I mean, you'll have sharks take a person. And often we've had this before where the mother and the father have been like, "We don't want the shark dead. Like, don't worry about it. Like, that's not going to help us grieve here." But sometimes you will get people who go like, "We got to go on a shark hunt. We got to hunt the shark down."
So unfortunate.
Anyway, anybody got any more on Lake Placid?
He doesn't go about it in the right way, but it is nice that Oliver Platt's character mentions that this croc is a keystone species as far as in some organism within a trophic food web that has a cascading effect on everything else below it, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only thing I quickly wanted to throw in from a physiology perspective is the difference between sedatives and tranquilizers. Because this happens a lot in different films. And just as a quick note, tranquilizers tranquilize you. They make you quieter. Sedatives sedate you. So whenever you see in the movie and they're like, "We're loading a tranquilizer in," and then they hit the animal and the animal like completely flattens out. No, they hit it with a sedative.
Okay, for those of us who didn't take semantics and pedantic literature 101 at university, what's the difference between tranquilizing someone and sedating them?
So if you're tranquilized, you get more easily able to deal with, you're quieter, you're in that state, as opposed to like sedatives are putting you out. So the specific definition is...
They both happen when Sam talks to you.
Yeah.
Sedatives directly depress the central nervous system, as opposed to tranquilizers are nervous system drugs that work as sort of sedative hypnotics. So basically they're impairing nerve function. They're making you quieter and easier to deal with.
Okay. And one of the problems also with this is that, like, the amounts are incredibly finicky, right? Like, they have no idea what they're dealing with. So they're either not going to affect it at all or probably kill it.
Yeah.
I think that they're not going to affect it at all, because the problem is that reptiles' physiology works on a basis where it's really hard to use sedatives and tranquilizers and other medications in reptiles, because their metabolic rate is so slow, they can slow down to a point that they're just very slowly metabolizing the drug. And if they're not actively carrying it into the central nervous system, we're not going to be in a base where we're going to knock them out. And also, most of these work a lot slower. Like, people are used to, they get shot with the tranquilizer dart, and then, you know, the human falls down or the animal falls down right away. And I did find it funny in the movie where they hit him with the dart, and they're all like, "Oh my God, he didn't go down right away." And then, like, sure enough, like 20 minutes later, finally it does go down, which I found a couple of good papers regarding crocodiles that basically said, yeah, it's going to probably take about 20 minutes using the right drugs, right drug combination, just to get them to a point where they're like, they're sedated, they're easily enough, they're barely able to kind of get up.
Goodness.
It's going to be a difficult point to get them there. And the croc isn't just going to like flatten and fall over. It's going to start to take on like a traditional drunken stupor. And then eventually it's going to become less able to manipulate with stimuli.
But I think in the movie, I mean, as we've said before, this crocodile is going to be really cold. He's not going to be moving around much. It's probably, when it, you know, jumps through that helicopter, it's probably just going to be all tuckered out.
Yep.
Yeah. So they may have got it to a point that it's metabolized and brought on enough of the medication. So that was actually something that I enjoyed. I just didn't enjoy the dumb humans being like, "We shot it and it didn't go down immediately."
It didn't go down immediately after shooting it in the jaw on its freaking bone.
Right. So they're not even aiming for any other area where you want to do intramuscular. That's where you would want the injection to go.
Nothing to be alarmed about. It's just a man pointing a bull tranquilizer at a coworker.
Dwight, you do not learn, do you? For a threat to be credible, you have...
Holy
No, you didn't. Sick of you and your...
It's all right. Andy approved it.
Okay, so, Piranha 3D. This movie is... I don't know how you guys feel about it, but this was tough to get through. I really hated this.
Really? I loved it.
Thank you.
Yes.
It's too much for me. Like, I know it's not trying to be a good film. I know it's just trying to be a schlocky B film. But I think, what was it? The point where the woman's, like, got her boobs out in the paragliding thing, yep. And her, like, the bottom half gets eaten. I'm just like, okay. We've done that, have we? And then, like, you know, the piranha burps out his dick. Dave, can you... someone describe the story for us.
Sure. So, the story takes place on Lake Victoria.
Not the Great Lakes, right?
Yep. No, just a small Lake Victoria that is one of the most popular spring break events in the United States. It's become, as it quotes itself, one of spring break's capitals. In traditional... Adam, I don't know. Did you ever go to spring break?
No.
Okay. So spring break is always shown as this typical, like, model-esque women everywhere ripping off clothing.
Hedonistic sex pit.
Right. Like, it's humans are still humans everywhere you go. You're still going to have, like, you're definitely going to have people enjoying themselves in the sun with liquor and bikinis, but not everybody is going to be going nuts. Anyways, a young teenage boy who's there with his local crush, Kelly. I can't even remember what the name of the boy is. It's Sandrat. I'm going to call him Sandrat.
Sandrat, yeah.
So Sandrat has been brought in by a local Girls Gone Wild producer or director, basically, to try and help with the movement of a hit the boat to try and find good locations for him to shoot his amateur pornography, I guess, soft porn.
Yeah, softcore porn, yeah.
During which his high school girl gets pulled into the mix, mainly because she's mad at her boyfriend for not having backstage tickets, which is supposed to make us root against him.
He also seems like a dick.
He proves himself to be a dick at the end with the motorboat.
Amazing scene. Okay, I will. Sorry. Yeah.
Anyways, the local sheriff is Sandrat's mother.
Elizabeth Shue?
Yeah, which is cool. Weird to see her.
There's some good actors in this film.
Mm-hmm.
The movie starts with the opening of a underwater lake, basically, that then empties up into Lake Victoria, killing Dreyfus.
Richard Dreyfus,
within the first, like, 5 minutes of the film, which seems to be the theme that these movies run on. And then putting us into a situation where the piranhas are now running free throughout the lake during spring break, biting various people in the midst of nudity and hedonistic acts.
Hell yeah.
Furthering the American idea of, if you show boob or have sex before marriage, God will punish you with monsters.
There will be a piranha.
Yep.
In your vagina.
Yeah.
Which I believe happens in Piranha 3DD.
3DD.
3DD, sorry, yeah. I guess you miss out the key context if you don't say 3DD, do you? Okay. Like I said, I thought this movie it was a bit too far. I do really enjoy the scene where that guy's just lost it and he's in the motorboat just chopping people into bits with his...
It was Ben Rames lowering the spinning motor in as he's trying to take out the piranhas left and right as they're slowly chewing him away as he's falling down into
get
the water.
Get out of the water!
Like, literally, get out of the water.
Yeah. I thought that was a really funny parody of a heroic death. Because Libby, you seem pretty keen on Dave's liking this film before. What do you like about this film?
To me, I'm always a big fan of that over the top humor. And I just feel like it completely embraces that. That scene where that woman's paragliding, I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah.
And especially the scene where I forget the actor's name, where he gets his little legs chomped. And he's just flailing his little legs on the boat.
He looks like Dane Cook, but he's not Dane Cook. Jerry McConnell?
Jerry McConnell. I think that's it.
Yes.
Yeah.
But which is kind of weird, because I hadn't caught this when I was first watching it. The film opens up, and do you know who the biggest producing studio on this film was?
No.
So this was a Weinstein film.
Was it?
Oh.
So, like, it opened up, and then, like, it has a character that very much feels Weinstein, who gets chomped by piranhas so badly that even his dick gets thrown away after. And this movie had a weird relationship between simultaneously trying to, like, show boob and nudity and be like, oh, women are objects, but then also being like, but we want to kill the scumbags that believe that.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not quite sure what the message was.
Well, especially because Elizabeth Shue is the sheriff, not some...
Yeah, she's great.
...man.
Yeah.
And she's awesome in it.
Yeah. But then also they had, like, when they first killed off Jerry, the porn producer.
Yeah.
And he gets, like, all chomped, and he throws the poor blonde in the bikini to the piranhas that, for some reason, they're just going after her while pretty much ignoring him.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, like, they're going to kill off, like, the dickhead. And then 5 minutes later, the other, like, what was she, British or Australian woman?
British. She's British, yeah.
Who, for some reason, they decide that they've got this tightrope in water that they're having trouble keeping tension on the line, so they make everybody crawl across the rope all at once, completely ignoring multiple laws of physics, but that's fine. Yeah. Where then the rope starts to descend into the water and they're all like, we're surprised that this is happening.
What?
And she's got like 2 meters of hair.
Yes.
She's just, all this hair seems to appear out of nowhere purely for like this scene. It's like,
but then she gets dragged down and I was like, she did nothing.
Yeah,
she did nothing wrong.
Goes on a list of characters we've covered recently who really don't deserve the brutality of their deaths.
No.
It's just a common theme in these monster movies of characters, especially female characters, just getting got because they deserve to be punished. Quotation marks there.
A lot of this movie, I feel like they were, you know, killing the dicks apart from Ving Rhames' heroic death. So that one came really out of the blue. Like, I thought she was going to have some, like, heroic, you guys go, I'll stay here.
But the blonde wasn't evil. The parasailing girl wasn't evil. There were a lot of women that were getting...
She was a floozy, Dave.
She was a floozy.
Right. They had a lot of women that just got chomped literally for showing some skin. And they were like, women die for showing skin and men die for pushing women into the piranhas to try and escape. And they're like, they're equal.
Welcome to America.
This is another movie where, apart from like the initial problem, because there's that thing at the end of the first movie where, oh, if those are the babies, where are the adults? And you're like, oh my God, they're all so fucked. Just get out of the lake and dose it with Rotenone and everything will be dead in 2 weeks. It's fine.
Right.
Go in the water. They can't get out like a crocodile can. Just don't go in the water.
Yeah, it feels even better than Lake Placid because at least the crocodile can get out of the lake. You know, so that might be a little bit of a fear there. But these piranhas aren't going to walk on land.
If you've watched Piranha Double D, you will know that they gain the ability to walk at the end of the film. So they are evolving.
Fantastic. Yeah.
I forgot about that documentary, Piranha 3DD.
Yeah, so there's a Rotenone is the piscicide? Piscicide? Piscicide, probably, yeah. Piscicide. It doesn't matter. Look, Rotenone is the fish-killing thing that you put into lakes. It's expensive. So this would be a really expensive operation, but you would do it and you would do it quickly and it wouldn't really be too much of an issue.
Right.
And you use it all the time.
Right. The second movie literally starts and they're like, yeah, we evacuated the entire town and then we dosed the entire lake and killed everything.
Yeah. Now, fish can survive. Sometimes fish can survive Rotenone treatments. It's very rare, but I mean, surely you would. We do this all the time. So like I said, I'm a freshwater ecologist. What often happens is if we want to get rid of an invasive species that's moved up into a lake that can potentially then spread, we'll just dose that source lake with Rotenone to cut off its, you know, A, it's the initial population, and stop the possibility of it spreading to other lakes. But we test, like people go back the next year and make sure that all of that species is gone. And you would do that multiple times with this lake. You would go, I mean, eDNA wasn't as widely used as it is now.
eDNA being what, Sam?
Environmental DNA. So there's this technology now where we can go out and you can just take water samples, go to a few places in the lake, drag just a Mount Franklin water bottle through the water, take that back, run it in the lab, see what fish are in the lake by just sequencing the DNA.
Oh, cool.
You can do that now, yeah. And we do. It is expensive. But we do it all the time, and in a situation where you potentially have a human loss of life, you wouldn't even question it. You would just do it straight away.
Especially in America.
There's still kids going down those slides!
Once these idiots get out of the water, it's not as if the fish are going to follow them home.
Help me!
You went back in the water. You little ginger moron.
Libby, do you think there's a way we can avoid that contrivance of, like... I mean, they kind of do it in the film. It's the fact is, you know, it's the classic Jaws thing. It's spring break. We have to let people in the lake. But after that, you would just get people out straight away when you've had multiple people die. Is there a way you could bring them back in there for the second film?
That's a good question. I think maybe if there was some kind of emergency in the town, say like a fire or something, and it's like driving people towards the water or, I don't know, I have to think about that.
Maybe the nut job, like Doc Brown, who pops up in this film, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's like, he turns out into a like Henry Wu style nut job, and he's like, yes. He wants to conserve this species so badly that he lets them back into the lake.
And make human piranha hybrids.
Yeah, I mean, I still enjoyed the second film. I thought the storyline obviously didn't flow as well.
Mm-hmm.
Also, nobody seems to understand that you just call Fish and Wildlife, or that a quarantine wouldn't be an area where they put like a rough metal fence around it and left the crazy scientists to just have a shack on the outside.
Yeah.
Well, we know it wouldn't work with what's been going on in the US with any kind of pandemic control, where they're trying to keep people home. And these nut jobs are going to the like houses of government with guns to be like, let us out. This is end the lockdown. This is like slavery.
Krusty wants out.
No, the world needs laughter.
Now, we should talk about the fact that piranhas do not behave like this in real life.
No.
Piranhas are cowardly,
docile scavengers of the sea.
Listen to a lot of Coldplay, that sort of thing. They're not hardcore.
They're omnivorous.
They are. They're omnivorous, exactly. Like they're not these, they don't strip a cow in 5 seconds.
Right. So just as a quick side, the piranhas in this are supposed to be a variant that was supposed to be dead for 2 million years that has been living in a underwater lake where the only explanation they can find of how they survived for so long without a food source is they have been self-cannibalizing and have now found themselves running around in modern day after the earthquake opened up that fissure and has allowed them to escape through it.
So we've talked about the whole process of cannibalism before, how if you've just got one species in a lake, happens a lot up in the Arctic with Arctic char, brown trout, perch, they will cannibalize if there's nothing else there for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it does happen sometimes with piranha as well. Like piranhas do eat each other if they're desperate.
Now, don't with cannibalistic species, don't some get a lot larger than others?
Yeah, absolutely. So you have dwarf morphs that will mainly prey on insects, invertebrates, larvae, that sort of thing. And then you have the bigger morphs that will prey on the dwarfs and each other.
And I forget, do we see that in the film at all? Or are they all just kind of relatively the same size?
Well, I mean, we get that last scene of like, they were just the babies, where then like the giant one comes along and takes out Adam's
spot. So it might have been two different morphs as opposed to... Yeah, I mean, it's a species we haven't seen for 2 million years as well. So why would he assume the physiology is the same as modern piranhas?
Because movie logic, Sam.
Yeah, and to be fair, it's not like, you know, he's given this air of credibility. He is shown to be crazy straight up.
Right, and on that note, I mean, the problem with self-cannibalized, you can't keep that up for 2 million years in a sealed-off underwater cave.
It's a closed system. There's no energy coming in there.
Right. You need a nutrient source.
You need plants, you need sunlight, something.
You need something. So, I mean, I could totally see if, like, different variants had evolved, if they had some sort of other... And they've got to have oxygen coming in as well. So they've got to have photosynthetic underwater plants that are basically putting oxygen back into the water for these fish to survive off of.
Yeah.
There are many problems with this whole sealed-off system. I know it's a really appealing idea to just be like, they found it down below. but, like... They've got to be eating something.
Yeah. So you do get a freshwater species. So there was this guy who gave a talk at a PhD retreat I was at last year. He's a cave diver, like underwater cave diver. So they'll go into these underwater cave systems, check stuff out, and they found what they thought was a new species of whitefish. Whitefish are really dodgy taxonomically. Like they might look completely different and be the same species, or they might, you know, look exactly the same and be different. It doesn't matter. He hadn't found a new species, it was something else, but it had evolved to look completely differently. It was in a cave system, so that can happen. But the issue is, there's input from, you know, like terrestrial, you know, the Earth's surface. You have plant matter, other invertebrates getting in there. If you have this sealed-off underground cabin, like we were saying, there's no source of anything. You can't get stuff from the surface or from a normal lake flowing down to it. That's the whole contrivance of the movie.
Right. They're also not going to be visual. There's no way that if they'd been on a sealed-off system that was that dark for that long...
2 million years.
Like, they may have some very atrophied vestibial eyes that would be remaining. But we know that even certain types of fish during the wintertime, when they're cut off from the surface and they're in dark underneath the ice, will actually atrophy and pull blood supply away from their eyes in order to conserve the energy they would be putting into a relatively high metabolic activity like visualization. And they go blind during the wintertime. So, Libby, I felt kind of like you did. I felt that the movie did a good job of just from a strictly monster perspective. Like, the monsters come out, they attack spring break, they do their thing, and they just happen to get the humans at that moment. But once the humans are out of the water, like, even when they're talking to Doc Brown's character and they're like, so, how do we kill them? And I was thinking, anyway. And, like, Doc Brown's character says that. He's like, you kill them like you kill fish. Like, humans have been killing fish for a long time.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I do have a question about that, about piranhas. What would ingesting that amount of silicone do to their bodies?
I was trying to watch this and give the piranhas some leeway. So, example, they don't eat any of the bodies.
They don't.
This is a species that is renowned for scavenging, and they leave so much meat on the bone over and over and over again, where, in fact, we see bodies, like, sinking to the bottom. That, like, they, like, the second movie, they have a woman who, like, she's been dead for a week, who she's at the bottom and they've just eaten her face. And they're, like, circling around her, but they're not eating her. And I'm like, what are you doing? Eat it.
Yeah. Stupid piranha.
Right. Like, you would be, like, they're still chewing their way through steel for new movement. Maybe it's just because they haven't encountered anything, like, human in a very long period of time.
Don't recognize them as prey.
Right. So maybe some ecosystem has started in the lake. Maybe they've had variants in other fish species that were down there. Maybe they're getting some energy source in via, like, a thermal vent. And they've got plant species and other things that have evolved to produce oxygen. All of that I can really, really stretch and make work if there is an entire other ecosystem outside of the piranhas that's in that underwater lake that's kind of balanced out to create, like, a little micro ecosystem. So I could understand them being around, but I don't know how their dietary requirements are going to adjust for eating human, for eating clothing, for eating silicon.
Yeah. So we've got these shy, more docile, omnivorous, blind,
scared,
confused, prehistoric fish.
Yeah.
How does this work from a story point, Libby?
Well, I was trying to think of a way that they could have been sort of untouched yet, you know, have all the energy and the nutrients that they need and not be blind. So maybe you have that man-made intervention, you know, up in kind of circling back to Maine, you know, they have that untouched wilderness. So maybe there was an area that they had a lake that had not been discovered that these fish cultivated and had life for thousands and thousands of years. And then man came along and maybe they were fracking or drilling or, you know, mining for like a, creating a quarry and blasted and connected these two lakes together.
Hmm. The lake would have to be connected to some other source, though.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can't have like a. I mean, water drainage basins stipulate that every like a bit of rainfall that you have in the whole of America is going to fall into one area, and so if you've got a lake, it's going to connect to other sources. But I mean, there have been cases where you'll have a lake somewhere where you've got a waterfall at one end, waterfall at the other end. So this really isolated little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so maybe this movie could have worked if it was set like 60 years ago when a lot of America was still America was pretty well explored 60 years ago as well. I don't know, put it in the Amazon
where the piranhas actually exist.
Spring break, I mean, Americans are going to South America all the time.
There we go,
spring break in the Amazon.
And hey, it'd be a nice political jab at Jair Bolsonaro as well. The Brazilians are like trying to make Brazil an alternative to Mexico for spring break. So they start up this, you know, this water park in the middle of nowhere. And all of a sudden, this rare species of piranha that's been around the whole time, but just hasn't been, you know, because there's so much of the Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that'd work.
I like that. We solved it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Let's party!
In the world's wildest water park, the party has never been hotter. Oh, yeah, it's a good time. And the guests have never been hungrier.
Now, Deep Blue Sea.
Love it.
It's so good.
I enjoyed this more than I thought I was going to. Yeah. Because this was another one in Australia when we had, like, when I was growing up. Maybe it was the same in the US. I sense it wasn't based on films I've seen in the past. But in Australia, when I was growing up, we had like 5 TV channels. And 3 of the main ones just replayed films over and over. True Lies was a big one. Independence Day was another one. Deep Blue Sea was a classic. Like, it'd be on every like 5-6 months. So I saw a lot of this film when I was a kid, and I loved it back then. Again, I came back to it with the same, like, oh, I don't know, but it's okay.
It's Samuel L. Jackson's speech is still
just
primo.
Spot on.
And had that happened before? Like, you have a big character that all of a sudden just get... Because everyone, you watch that film, and you just assume he's going to be one of the survivors.
Yeah, exactly.
Or at least make it to the very, very end. I think when I saw that movie in theaters, when that shark jumped out and just snatched him, everyone was like, what?
Exactly, yeah. And you can blame it on the CGI, because that's one of the points of this film where all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there's this really jarring CGI, like rubbery Samuel L. Jackson body. Yeah. I mean, it's late 90s. So
the robot shark's great.
Practical effects look amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Does somebody want to take us through the plot of this one?
Yeah, so you've got this research base called Aquatica, set in the Pacific Ocean. Basically, these researchers are trying to find a way to cure Alzheimer's. One of the main characters has a grandparent or a father of some family relation who has Alzheimer's. So she's very, very motivated to make this work. And their whole plan for this is to get some protein from a shark's brain that not only resists, but it can actively destroy Alzheimer's somehow.
Reverse
Alzheimer's, yeah. And so their plan is, because they can't get enough protein from a normal-sized shark, they're going to increase the brain size of these sharks so they can get more protein instead of figuring out and then artificially synthesizing it. So they're in this underwater base, which is an old naval submarine dock. So it looks pretty like Cold War, industrial, a lot of concrete everywhere. Really cool setting.
Mm.
And they have the shark wrangler. What's his face?
Thomas Jane. A very blonde Thomas Jane.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I recognized him. You got LL Cool J, the best, coolest cook with his bird.
Back when he was actually, you know, doing good movies. Back when he was another success story of, like, the crossovers of hip-hop to acting. What was the last film he was in that was...
He's on TV shows.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he made the switch from film to TV.
Mm-hmm.
CSI...
NCIS.
Yeah, NCIS New...
Los Angeles, which is just a serialized, you know, crime show that he's been on for years. He probably makes at least $1 million a season.
Fair enough, yeah. But he used to be, like, in blockbusters all the time. He used to just pop up in them. He's a good actor. Him and Will Smith, right up there in terms of, yeah, rappers who really made it in film.
His character's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And he actually had the good acting. Libby brought up a good point in the movie. He's the only one that treats this water as cold as it really would be.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Everyone seems nonplussed that this water is freezing, except for him.
Yes, including... what's the name of the female lead again?
Idiot.
It's some weirdly obnoxious British name.
Yeah, so the sharks are too smart. They find a way to kill everyone by taking poor Skeleton Skarsgård's arm and ramming him through a glass window. And then they're loose in the facility, killing everyone. And that's our wonderful Deep Blue Sea movie.
But they're not seeking... They're seeking partial revenge, but mostly they're seeking freedom.
That's it.
The other dumb thing here is that, like, I don't know if anyone's seen sharks jump out of the water, but those fences at the compound are not that high. Like, they could clear that easily.
I think he says they're, like, 8 feet.
Yeah, that's it. And a great white breaches, like, 15 feet when it rams a seal from the bottom. They get up high.
So, here's the disappointing part of Deep Blue Sea, which, not disappointing, but just sort of where they got the idea from. So...
The bird died? That's pretty disappointing.
The Alzheimer's research.
Oh.
Alzheimer's, one of the mechanisms, because there's a lot, but one of the ones that we tend to focus on the most is you've got this system of amyloid proteins that are synthesized in the brain that sit inside the skull that are totally fine on their own. And you've got sort of two variants of them that the body splices and cuts. And later on in life, when Alzheimer's activates, one of the things that seem to happen is that your normal processes get altered such that you start generating this third variant of the amyloid protein that really doesn't do anything. It's kind of a useless protein variant. And the problem is that it starts to clump together inside of the skull in the cerebral spinal fluid, where it then descends and it can stick in the brain, where it starts to cause neuronal pathways to break down and decay, leading into one of the factors that's leading us to Alzheimer's. So a lot of Alzheimer's based on looking at, is there some way that we can genetically stop these plaques from forming, or is there some way that we can actually send something into the skull to try and potentially pull those plaques out to destroy them and break them down? And so there is actually ongoing research associated with these types of proteins and using them in sharks. So there's a Dutch bio company called CrossBeta that last put out some data in 2017. I couldn't find anything going on past that, but they're specifically looking at beta amyloid like antibodies. So they're looking at training the immune system to attack these plaques. And they found that sharks have really, really tough immune systems. And the antibodies that they build are really big, they're fairly large, and they've got these really defined loops to basically tell the immune system, hey, come in and attack this. And so they've been of interest for quite some time because like they're robust, you can boil them, you can smash them around, and you don't really do anything to them. And
you can piss on them, bury them for 6 months, and then eat them.
They penetrate really, really well into the brain. So human antibodies are around 150 kilodaltons. They're really big. Shark antibodies are small. They're like 12 to 13. So there's been a whole bunch of research, and this company actually has a patent and is working on Mako sharks to say, hey, we think we might be able to design really small antibodies that will be able to penetrate into the brain and will potentially be able to tell the body, hey, these beta amyloid plaques, these developing proteins that shouldn't be there, this is what the immune system should be coming in, destroying, attacking, and removing from the brain. And if you get them early enough, then maybe we'll be able to slow or potentially stop Alzheimer's development. So this is a real thing, using sharks. But they're not using their brains.
No.
They're using the shark's immune system.
Yeah.
So like I could totally see like a shark, and it would be a much less interesting film if it came in and they're like, we've increased its lymphoid capabilities drastically. And it's just a shark with these huge lymph nodes off the side of it. It's just like, oh. And everyone would be like, oh, okay, cool.
So it's like a Popeye goldfish.
Right. Now, the other problem is that we have this really, really bad theory in all of medicine where we go like, bigger brain means smarter creature.
Yeah.
Mice and rats are very intelligent. They have tiny little brains.
Yeah.
Yep.
And turning it into like Pinky and the Brain style giant skull, you don't necessarily need a larger brain to be better at solving problems.
Right.
So the idea that they were like, we enlarged the brain of the shark and it became instantaneously smarter. And it's like, no.
Yeah. I've mentioned this before, but Neanderthals had larger brains than Homo sapiens did, or than Homo sapiens do. Most of us still have brains. But they had much larger brains because the parts of the brain that related to vision, for instance, were much larger because they were cave-based. They needed to see in the dark. But, I mean, they definitely weren't smarter.
No. So, I mean, maybe they talk about that they're switching with genes to enhance the intelligence. Maybe they have spliced something in which has increased their neuronal capabilities. But again, there's also a difference between intelligence and knowledge.
Yeah.
That this creature is operating in such a way that it's not only figuring out the problems, but it seems to have some understanding of like, it needs it to get to the ocean, even though it's been bred and designed in this facility, or it needs to reach these areas, all of which are big gaps that require knowledge base.
Yeah. There's also some huge, like, okay, so for instance, when it recognizes the gun, a smart creature, land-based creature that has seen guns operate before, I totally buy that they could potentially recognize a gun. But the fact that they take out the security cameras,
yeah,
like they have no reference whatsoever for what those things do.
Right.
Unless they're just attacking anything that looks like human technology, I guess.
That would be the entire facility.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because then at some point, everything's human technology.
Yeah. But I mean, a cage, for instance, they might not think of as technology.
Yeah.
But anything that's not a cage that they're in, for instance, if they're just going for like bolts or like levers or whatever, then maybe they'd attack the cameras.
Helicopters.
Yeah. As soon as that door opens and you see the storm, I'm like, and also, okay, so Cammy pointed this out. Why do you have the cook stay for the weekend, but not medical staff?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, surely anyone can make you a fucking meal over the weekend, but you don't have like a physician on staff?
That's a good point.
Well, he's got to be there to cook the birthday dinner for the stupid British scientist.
Oh, yeah. Did we figure out who the actor was?
Her name is...
Saffron Burrows.
Saffron Burrows, okay. It was the first time I saw a film when I was younger, and I thought, that character's not just dumb for the movie, that is the poorly written decision. When she jumps into the water, it's so stupid.
Oh, yeah.
It's infuriating. Like, so maybe you could say the shark, because it's smarter, it knows that she's not in the water if she's just dripping blood in there because it can't smell anything. But then she's not like even hovering near the edge. She just jumps into a place where she doesn't know if she can get out or not. She goes for that rung later, but it's only one rung. It's not big enough to get her up onto land, and it just falls off straight away. And then Thomas Jane doesn't try to shoot the shark. He just tries to jump in with it. What? Sorry.
Thomas Jane does so many obnoxious dives in this movie, unnecessary sprawling dives, that to me, that is the biggest plot hole. It's like, why are you diving again?
In the way, constantly.
You are diving in the way of other people.
I bet he did like 3-4 weeks of diving training. And he just rocked up on set. He's like, I have to use every hour of effort I've put into this. Like, there's no reason for you to dive in. I'm diving in. There's no reason. Your character wouldn't do this. I'm fucking diving in.
We don't even mean the water. We just mean, like, they're running down a hallway, and he's, like, flopping onto the ground to, like, try to stop.
Baseball slides.
It's ridiculous. There's at least, like, 3 points where they're trying to get through a door, and we counted them, where he just jumps in front of people and kind of, like, blocks the door for a second because he slipped, and they're, like, tripping over him, and they're, like, trying to, like, climb up. It's like, what are you doing?
It is ridiculous, yeah. If we've got any Australian listeners, Jacqueline McKenzie's in this, doing a pretty good American accent, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
The blonde woman?
Yeah, blonde.
Sorry, it's a bit of a deep cut for the US, but if anybody watched Blue Heelers back in the day, regional Australian TV, don't worry about it, it's fine. But yeah, she pops up in this, which was kind of fun.
Stellan Skarsgård doing his typical growly, non-accent accent.
Random North/Eastern European character. Him and Peter Stormare. I thought they were like, I don't know, Bulgarian or something until I, you know, moved to the Nordic countries, and they're like, yeah, they're Swedes. All right, is there anything else we want to mention here? Have we talked about the shark swimming backwards thing and why it doesn't work?
No, we haven't.
Okay.
Yeah, they can't swim backwards, and also their nose is like the most sensitive part of their body, and they're ramming steel doors.
Over and over again.
Is there any way that you could ram something as a shark?
No, you're made of cartilage.
They're bouncy.
What are we going to do, Buzz?
Use your head.
But I don't want to use my head!
Ow! All right, so I think we are good for today then, guys. Adam or Libby, do you have any extra points to add to any of our discussions?
I think just how would the story change? If these sharks can't swim backwards, they're not necessarily going to be smarter because they have bigger brains, and they're not going to be ramming doors.
Well, I think from the get-go, there wouldn't be a story because they'd just jump that fence.
It's just the helicopter pulls up as the sharks are going over, and there's one of the characters standing there. It's just like, shit.
Yeah.
That was beautiful. Like a Free Willy scene where you're just jumping over the fence. Thomas Jane's like flopping on the deck somewhere.
Honestly, I would really like to see the opening scene of just the sharks with the enlarged lymphoid tissue and some scientist being like, we don't know where this is going to lead us. And it's just these poor sharks like circling in the glass with these giant lymph nodes, just being like, this is awful.
Yeah, you can't keep a shark. They've never been able to keep a shark that big in captivity, ever.
Right, exactly. And it's building that facility as well out in the middle of the ocean, rather than creating some sort of land-based system where you could bring and just building off into the water.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Right? Like, no, it has to be accessible only by a helicopter in the middle of the... Like, no.
Well, I think they did that because of the illegality of it.
Yeah.
Oh, right, yes.
What they were doing was very illegal.
Right. Fair enough.
Yeah, but all in all, fantastic movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, loved it.
Fantastic movie.
Jump, Free Willy! Jump! Jump with all your might!
No, Willie didn't make it, and he crushed our boy.
Ugh, what a mess.
Oh, I don't like this new director's cut.
Well, I think that's all that we wanted to talk about for this week. Adam, do you want to sign us off?
Absolutely. Remember, the monsters aren't real, but these real-life animals and the science is.
All right, bye, guys.
Bye.
It has existed since prehistoric times. It was worshipped by primitive cultures. It can kill a man, with one crushing bite.
Piranha hunt in packs. The first bite draws blood. The blood draws the pack.
In the most advanced research facility in the world, a team of specialists is working against the clock to benefit mankind. But before they can save millions of lives, they'll have to find a way to save their own. Lake Placid. Piranha. Deep Blue Sea.